How about now? The book of Nehemiah. The book of Nehemiah is the last in the chronological order of the historical books. The first 17 books of the Old Testament are historical books. Before we get to Job and we go into the poetical books, the first 17 are historical. Now, Nehemiah is the 16th book, not the 17th. So there is one more to come after it, and that's the book of Esther. But if you'll remember, we saw last week in studying Ezra that the book of Esther, those events actually took place between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7. During that 60-year gap between those two things in Ezra, that's when Esther took place. So though Esther comes after these two books, chronologically, it's within the book of Ezra, which would make Nehemiah the last book of the historical books in that sense. So we're at the end of the historical books. At the end of Nehemiah, they're rebuilding the temple. And the next great event on the calendar is the birth of Jesus Christ in Bethlehem's manger. Now we're going to go back from here to read about Job, who is the oldest of all these. We're going to read the Psalms of David, who lived back in 1st and 2nd Samuel. We're going to read about Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, who all lived during the years of the 10 northern tribes and their freedom before their captivity. And then all the minor prophets have prophesied there. So all the rest of the books, we can really pick up and set back to where we've already been. Nehemiah is the conclusion of this historical account running from Genesis all the way to where we're at this evening. The events of Nehemiah take place 12 years after the conclusion of the book of Ezra. In the book of Ezra, we saw the building of the temple, the building of the altar, the sacrifices as the people came back. Then it is 12 years later where the book of Nehemiah picks up where Ezra left off. There are several contrasts between these two books, Ezra and Nehemiah. In fact, the scholars tell us, and that's just for what it's worth, the scholars tell us, that Ezra and Nehemiah were one book in the Torah, and that somewhere down the line they were divided into two books, Ezra and Nehemiah. I would simply say this, that must have been God's providence, because Ezra was written by someone different than Nehemiah was written by. We saw that Ezra was written by Ezra. Well, Nehemiah is written by none other than Nehemiah. We know that because verse 1 says, "The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, it came to pass in the month Chislu, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan the palace." The writer says, "I was in Shushan the palace," and that writer is Nehemiah. And so we know that Nehemiah wrote Nehemiah and Ezra wrote Ezra, so it's God's providence that these two books are two different books and not one, as they supposedly are in the Torah. Notice the contrast between these two books. And again, this is why they ought to be two books and not one. In Ezra, you remember Zerubbabel? He came first to build the temple, and then Ezra came to worship at the altar. In Ezra, Zerubbabel was of the line of David, and Ezra was of the line of Aaron, a royal and a priestly leader, Zerubbabel and Ezra. But in Nehemiah, and I put this politely in our paper, Nehemiah is a nobody. All right, I put it this way, he is of no noteworthy lineage. All right, verse 1 we just read, "The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah." Well, who is Hakaliah? He only appears one other time, and that's in chapter 10 in verse 1, where it says, "Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah." There's no other mention of him. Now we know Zerubbabel, the son of David, we know David. Ezra, of the seed of Aaron, we know Aaron, but we don't know Hakaliah. And I think the great thing out of that is it's wonderful that God can use a descendant of David to build the temple and a descendant of Aaron to worship at the temple. But it's also nice that God can use a nobody. That God can raise up a Nehemiah who's just in the right place at the right time, so to speak, and God can raise him up. Nobody knows who he is. Nobody knows about him. He's got no lineage. He's got no ancestry to brag about. He's the everyday guy that can be used of God because he's willing to be. In fact, even among Bible characters, Nehemiah is kind of a forgotten or forlorn person. I think it'll be a sad thing when many people get to heaven and run into Nehemiah. And he says to them, "Hey, did you read the book I wrote?" Well, what book was that? Well, the book of Nehemiah. So he is a forgotten and unnoticeable character, but greatly used by God. Also in Ezra, Zerubbabel and Ezra were born in Israel, were taken into captivity, and then in the book of Ezra, they return back to Israel. So they have seen the captivity. They've seen the suffering of the people. They know the agony that Israel's gone through in being drug out of their land and scattered to the four winds. But Nehemiah has never seen Israel before. He's never seen Jerusalem. He was born in captivity. He was born in Persia. And so here is a Jew born in a foreign and strange land that's never seen the worship of Jehovah at the temple. And so that plays into his strong desires and emotions that we read about in chapter 1 when he hears about great affliction and reproach in verse 3. When he hears about that, he's greatly moved by it. And that's because he's never seen that before, and so he's anxious to go by. The contrast between him and Zerubbabel and Ezra. In Ezra, Ezra was a priest and a teacher. Nehemiah was a politician. Ooh, we already don't like him. All right, Ezra was a priest and a teacher. He was concerned with the, and here's our blank, purification of the people. Ezra was concerned with the purification of the people. Remember what happened in the last chapter of Ezra? There were some of the Jews that had married Gentile wives because they'd been out there scattered in, and they brought them back to Jerusalem, and Ezra had to deal with that situation. He was interested in the purification of the people. Ezra's emphasis was a spiritual emphasis. He was a priest and a teacher. But Nehemiah was a politician. In fact, in chapter 12 and verse 26 of Nehemiah, he's called the governor. And when you run the timeline of the book of Nehemiah, he was the governor of Jerusalem for 36 years. So he is without a doubt a politician. He wasn't so much interested with the purification of the people, though he was. It's not that he didn't care about that. But he was more concerned with the protection of the people of Jerusalem. That's why he built the walls. He wanted the walls built for the protection of the people. To keep the enemy outside and keep the people of God inside. He said, why do you want to keep them inside? To make them prisoners? No, to keep them away from the idolatry and the wickedness that was on the outside. Now that they've gotten inside the Jerusalem and built the walls, let's keep the world outside. The church would do good to do that in our day, that once we get in here, keep the world outside. But too many churches, in an effort to reach more people, are bringing the world inside. Their standards, their morals, their dress codes, their music, their lighting, everything else. So we find that Nehemiah was concerned with the protection of the people. The theme of Nehemiah, here's our next paragraph. The theme of Nehemiah is building the wall. That's what Nehemiah is about. Building the wall. The president would be proud. Nehemiah is about building the wall. After hearing about the condition of the people of Jerusalem, again in chapter 1, it says the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, came to pass in the month Chislu, in the 20th year, I was in Shushan the palace, that Hanani, one of my brethren, and you can put a cross-reference, chapter 7, verse 2, Hanani, one of my brethren, Hanani is called Nehemiah's brother. So he's not speaking brethren in a generic sense, but he's actual one of his brothers, according to chapter 7, verse 2. Hanani, one of my brethren, came, he and certain men of Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews that had escaped, which were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity there are in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. And it came to pass when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Nehemiah was moved emotionally when he heard about the reproach and the suffering, the affliction of the people of Jerusalem, though he'd never been there. That's his home country. That's where his parents were from. And he had a special affection toward it. So when he heard about those things, what did he do? Well, we kind of read fast through this. What did Nehemiah do when he heard about that? Well, he went before the king and asked if he could go back to Jerusalem to fix things. Well, notice this. In verse number 1, it said, it came to pass in the month Chislu. Turn to chapter 2 and verse 1, if you would. And it came to pass in the month Nisan. The month Nisan is the first month of the year in the Jewish calendar. We would call it January. And the month of Chislu is kind of like our August. Now, the difference between Jewish calendars and ours, the Jewish calendar went from the 14th to the 14th, where ours goes from the 1st to the 1st. So there's all kinds of confusion in there. Let's just boil it down to say this. From Chislu to Nisan are 4 months. All right, there's 4 months between those two. Nehemiah didn't just throw up a quick prayer in chapter 2 and verse 4. When the king said to me, for what dost thou make thy request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. We talk about that quick Nehemiah prayer, that as he's standing before the king as the cupbearer, and the king sees that his countenance is sad, and he's worried because that's not a good thing for the king to see your countenance to be sad. So he throws up a quick prayer. Well, it's not just that he threw up a quick prayer. He'd been spending 4 months in prayer. A quick prayer at the time of need is not going to cover up all the time of not praying. God is not a yo-yo. God does not come down when you need Him to and then go away for the next 3 or 4 weeks or 3 or 4 months when you don't need Him, so you don't talk to Him. Then when you need Him, you talk to Him all of a sudden again. No, Nehemiah had a long process of talking to God and praying to God so that when he prayed to Him in chapter 2 and verse 4, God answered that prayer. But Nehemiah spent 4 months praying after he heard about the walls of Jerusalem, seeing what he could do about it. Nehemiah sacrifices his position as the king's cupbearer, the last verse, the last statement in verse number 1. Nehemiah says, for I was the king's cupbearer. Now, it doesn't say taste tester. Or sometimes we think of Nehemiah and say, well, yeah, his job was to taste the wine before he gave it to the king. So he was just kind of a sacrificial lamb, because if the wine was bad, boom, he's dead. But the king's cupbearer was not the one that did it. He's the one that prepared the wine. He's the one that squeezed the grapes into the cup and brought it to the king. It was a very noble position. It was a very esteemed position. And not anyone could, anybody that had a position of coming before the king had to meet requirements. They had to be intellectual. They had to have personality. They had to have good looks, all right? They couldn't have blemishes. They couldn't be dwarfs. They couldn't be all that. If they were going to be daily before the king, he was going to hear the workings of the courthouse. So this was a very esteemed position he was in, and yet he sacrifices that position to go back to Jerusalem to live among those that are in great affliction and poverty. So we're impressed with Nehemiah being willing to give up that position. In chapter 2, he goes with letters from the king to the governors beyond the river, chapter 2, verse 7, and Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, chapter 2 and verse 8. A letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace which appertaineth to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me. Nehemiah knew what to ask for. Letters to the governors of the land so they would see the king gave permission. We're going to read later in the book that Tatnai, one of the governors, stops Nehemiah from building. Nehemiah says, no, I've got the king's permission. He doesn't believe it. Sends a messenger back to the king to find out it's true. So these letters help Nehemiah, and he goes back with them. In chapter 3, then, Nehemiah organizes the people of Jerusalem into 42 groups. I'm impressed by this. Any man that can get 42 groups of people on the same page to do the same thing is a special fella. And if you read chapter 3, it talks about who builded. Next to him builded the men of Jericho, and next to them builded Zachar, the son of Imri. Next to them repaired Meremoth, the son of Urijah, the son of Koz. And so these 42 groups of people built the wall, the towers, and the gates of the old city of Jerusalem. That's a pretty noble task. You know, they could only do that if they were organized. I think the Lord believes in organization. Let all things be done decently and in order. Again, one of my pet peeves is hearing people say, I don't believe in organized religion. Well, then you're not in step with God. Because God believes in organization. God believes that things ought to be done decently and in order, not just haphazardly, not just how things are thrown together. He got these 42 groups all working on different sections of the wall and the gates, the fish gate and the sheep gate and the fountain gate and the dung gate. Believe me, you wanted a dung gate in that city. You wanted a place where all that stuff was taken outside of the city. In the sanitation conditions back in that day, without outhouses and plumbing and all that, you needed a dung gate. And so they built all that stuff, 42 groups of people organized. And they didn't, if you read it, they didn't start here on the east side and work their way around. It all went up at the same time, simultaneously. They were all building at the same time so that all the wall went up at the same time. Now, they were not without opposition. All this was done with great opposition from the Samaritans. Remember the Samaritans? All right, those in the New Testament that opposed Christ, the Samaritans, the half-Jew, half-Gentile, they're all the way back in the Old Testament as the enemies of God. Who are they? They're the Jews that had been taken away from Jerusalem, mingled with the Gentiles, had their offspring and those children and their children's children were the half-breed Jews and less Jew as the generations went down and ignoring the God of Israel and worshiping on the mountains and things like that. And they are the enemies of the Jew. And they come to try to stop Nehemiah from building the wall. It grieves them that someone is seeking the welfare of the people of Jerusalem. So they have great opposition from the Samaritans. In chapter 4 and chapter 6, 1 to 9, you can read that. But not only that, they have oppression from the inside. Opposition from the outside. Oppression from the inside. The richer Jews were oppressing the poorer Jews. The poorer Jews that didn't have the money to feed themselves and do that, the richer Jews were loaning them money on usury and then having them pay back by selling them their lands, their children, their possessions, and Nehemiah gets upset with them. And he goes in there in chapter 5, and he rails upon them to stop that oppression of the people against their own people. And guess what? In all this organization, and in spite of the opposition, look at chapter 6 and verse 15. So the wall was finished. In the 25th day of the month Elul, in 52 days. I'm glad you're seated. That would have knocked you off your feet. They built the walls of Jerusalem and the towers and the gates, even with opposition, in 52 days. Again, I kind of got a chuckle. How long has our president been wanting to build a wall? About 52 months. In 52 days, they had the wall. They didn't have to go through Congress. They didn't have to get funding. They just went and built the wall. They just did it. So in 52 days, in spite of the opposition, in spite of the oppression, because they all had a mind to work, and they all threw their hands into it. It's amazing what you can accomplish when everybody puts their mind to it. When everybody works, not just the 10%, but everybody puts their hand to the work. In 52 days, the job was completed. And the walls were built. They're now safe and secure in Jerusalem. The temple is built. The altar is there. The walls have been built up. Things are good in Jerusalem again. Let's look at the key words in Nehemiah. And of course, these key words always bring us back to the theme of what we're looking at. One of the key words is the different forms of the word build. Build, built, buildeth, builders, and buildest. Those words appear 25 times in these few chapters in the book of Nehemiah, because that's what it's all about. Building. Building. They're rebuilding the walls and the towers and the gates of Jerusalem. The word wall appears 34 times. Again, these things all go together to show us where the emphasis is. The word work, that dirty four-letter word. The word work appears 21 times. The work in building the walls. These were not Baptists. They got it done in 52 days. They didn't have to have a committee to vote on everything. We don't either, but it's fun to say anyways. The word so. And the word so in the book of Nehemiah indicates a continuation of that. So we did this, and so we did that, and so we went here. It shows the continuation, the rapid movement. That's why it could get done in 52 days. Because there was a continuous effort moving on. The word so appears 32 times in the book of Nehemiah. Emphasizing the work and the wall and the building that got the job done in 7.5 weeks, in 52 days, less than 2 months. An overview of the book of Nehemiah then. That gives us pretty much the purpose of it and what it's about. And the overview will pretty much take us through the same thing, at least through the first 6 chapters. And again, that's the division. The first 7 chapters are about the work. There's our word again, the work. The first 7 chapters of Nehemiah, there, just like Ezra had 2 divisions, Nehemiah has 2. And the first one from verse chapter 1 to 7 are the work. Chapters 1 to 6 are about reconstruction. That's our word in the outline, reconstruction. They are rebuilding the walls. The walls had been built once before. They're just putting them back together. Nebuchadnezzar had come in and destroyed the city and burnt down the walls. And now they're going to rebuild them. In the work of reconstruction, number one in chapter one, we see the work envisioned. That's with an E. E-N-V-I-S-I-O-N-E-D. Envisioned. The work envisioned. Nehemiah chapter 1 again. Nehemiah learns of the need, and he weeps and mourns and fasts and prays. He just doesn't run to the task. He spends some time praying about it first. Sometimes we get over anxious. Sometimes we do things and then look back and say, why did I do that? Why did I commit? So the Bible says if you're going to build, what man that's going to build doesn't sit down first and count the cost to see whether he has enough to complete it? How many times have you seen buildings that were started but not completed because they ran out of funds, ran out of money, ran out of laborers? So Nehemiah didn't rush to this. He sought and he wept and he fasted and he prayed. He envisioned the work. In chapter 2, the work is planned. The work is planned. Again, that's where we saw the letter sent to the governors. And the letter sent to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, to gather wood and timber so they would have it for the construction. An organized blueprint. All right, envisioning the work, then planning the work, then number 3, the work begun. And that's chapter 3. Chapter 3 is the blueprint of how it was built. In verse number 1, we read about the sheep gate. In verse 2, the fish gate, or verse 3, the fish gate. Verse number 6, the old gate. Verse number 13, the valley gate. Verse 15, the dung gate. I'm reading a book right now about World War II and Auschwitz, the prisoner of war camp, and the filthiness and without going into much detail, when they first brought these train full of Jews in, they would take them into the shower, not the shower that you're thinking of, but an actual shower to clean them up. When they got them there, they would put them in that shower. It was ice cold water. But most of the prisoners had been dehydrated by that point and were waiting for that water with their mouths wide open. And a great number of them ended up dying of dysentery from the water they drank from that shower when it first came out, when they first got there. And that dysentery, many of them didn't last more than a couple weeks or a couple months in that thing, but you need to get that stuff out. That dung has to get out because it just causes death. So the organization and the thought that's put into all this building, planning for even the things that we don't really care to think about. Number 5, the gate of the fountain. Verse 15, the gate of the fountain. The end of verse 29, the east gate. The end of verse 31, the gate Mifkad. And then back to verse 32, and the sheep gate. And then between each of these gates, groups building the walls that connect the gates one to another. I sat down and looked at a map of this online as I was preparing for this to get it in my mind. It's no way to show it to you, but it just shows the wall and then the gates as they're not evenly spaced around. The dung gate and the gate of the fountain are both at the southern end of it. The sheep gate and the fish gate are at the north end. The gates are around there, but sections of wall between. And all of it went up simultaneously as they were building all at the same time with that mind to work. So the work begun. Number 4, we talked about this already, the work threatened. In chapter 4 and 5, the work threatened. Small letter A, opposition from without. That's Sanballat and Tobiah. And the army. Where is that at? Chapter 6? No. Sanballat and Tobiah. And it says the army of the Samaritans somewhere in there. Yeah. Chapter 4, verse 1, Sanballat spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, what do these feeble Jews? So the opposition from without, then letter B, the oppression from within. The oppression from within. And again, that was the wealthier Jews oppressing the poorer Jews. One thing I read about again in that book as they were on the trains going to Auschwitz. One thing that was impressive to some of them was that those that had more food with them gave to those that didn't have it. There seemed to be no hoarders, no greedy people. They were sharing. Even in the prison camps, the tendency was to do that. But here, these Jews within the walls of Jerusalem, the richer were oppressing the poor. And then number 5, the work finished in chapter 6. Again, in the short span of 52 days, this work was finished. It was completed and done. Then letter B, letter A was the reconstruction in chapters 1 to 6. Chapter 7 is the resettlement. Letter B, the resettlement. Now the Jews need to resettle. Many of them had come from Babylonia, come back to build, but they didn't want to stay there. They wanted to go back to their houses. They wanted to go back to their stores and shops. They wanted to go back to where they'd been raising their families. And so you read in the book of Nehemiah that they sat down and had a genealogy and decided that 1 out of every 10 would stay in Jerusalem. That 9 could go back after the walls were built, but 1 in every 10 had to stay. They had to populate Jerusalem. They needed people in there now. So 1 in 10 stayed behind. The Bible says that 1 in 10 willingly stayed behind. So that was the resettlement. So chapters 1 to 7 are the work, then number 2, the worship. Chapters 8 to 13. The worship. Chapters 8 through 10 are about consecration. Those that stayed behind in the walls of Jerusalem now have a revival meeting. Nehemiah chapter 8 is one of my favorite chapters in all the Bible, and we call it, and it's number 1 under here, the Bible Conference. That must be why I like it so much. The Bible Conference. I don't have this on the outline, but if you want to jot it down, I've written this in my Bible, just about chapter 8. In chapter 1 and 2, the Bible conference convenes. They gather the people together in chapter 1 and 2. It convenes. In verse 3 to 8, it's conducted. They read in the law and they give the understanding of it. Ezra stands up on a pulpit of wood and reads the law to the people. So it's conducted in verse 3 to 8. It's concluded in verse 9 to 17. The Bible conference concludes in verse 9 to 17, and then it's continued in verse 18. Also, day by day, from the first day to the last day, he read in the book of the law of God. It was a continuing Bible conference. I like that. So the consecration in chapter 8 to 10, it's a Bible conference in chapter 8. It's the bitter confession in chapter 9. The bitter confession. And that's the prayer of the people. The Levites and the Kadmiel and Bani and Hashabniah and Sherebiah and Hodijah stand up and bless the Lord forever and ever. And blessed be the glorious name which is exalted above all blessing and praise. And they begin to confess the sins of Israel. They say in verse 17, "But thou art a God ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness, and forsookest them not." Verse 21, 40 years didst thou sustain them in the wilderness so that they lacked nothing, their clothes waxed not old, and their feet swelled not. So it's a great confession, a bitter confession. Then number 3, the blessed covenant in chapter 10. The blessed covenant. These are those 1 and 10. The people that are sealed and stay in Jerusalem to continue on the populating of it. The blessed covenant. Then letter B, chapters 11 to 13, consolidation. There's our big word for tonight. Consolidation. Chapter 11 is redistribution. Not of wealth, like the liberals want, but redistribution of the population, putting people in houses, spreading them throughout the city, putting those 1 in 10 in their places, repopulating the city of Jerusalem. Chapter 12, number 2, is the rededication. The rededication, chapter 12, verse 27. "And at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought the Levites out of all their places to bring them to Jerusalem, to keep the dedication with gladness, both with thanksgiving and with singing, with cymbals and psalteries and with harps. The sons of the singers gathered themselves together, both out of the plain country round about Jerusalem and from the village of Netophathi. The rededication. Then finally, number 3 in chapter 13, the reform. Nehemiah reforms abuses. The people had given Tobiah lodging in Jerusalem. Tobiah, one of their enemies. Nehemiah runs him out, kicks him out. It says in verse 11, "Then contended I with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken?" Verse 17, "Then I contended with the nobles of Judah, said to them, why do this evil thing that you do?" Verse number 25, "And I contended with them." 3 times in this chapter, Nehemiah says, "I contended with them." He straightened them out. "I contended with them and cursed them and smote certain of them and plucked off their hair and made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters unto their sons nor take their daughters unto your sons for yourselves." The great reform that took place in Jerusalem. All this is leading up to the coming of the Messiah. All this is building Jerusalem back up, and by the time we get 400 years later to the arrival of Christ, the city of Jerusalem has exploded in population. And from this small remnant, from this small beginning, is the great population that's there, and the worship and the temple, and then become the Sadducees and the Pharisees and all the systems that work back in. All start from Nehemiah 400 years before Christ. and then bring us right to the book of Matthew, where Christ is born of the lineage, house and the lineage of David, and comes into the world. So Nehemiah, they'll place this halfway in the first half of the Old Testament, brings us right to the book, or right to the door of Matthew, and all the books in between them are going back over and filling in the gap of areas we've already looked at. So the whole history of Israel is covered from Genesis through Nehemiah, and of course Esther going back in its place also. And then from there we move on to the material that goes back within that time frame of Genesis through Nehemiah. So Nehemiah rightfully is the last book chronologically of the historical books about the history of Israel. We've started from one to the other, from Genesis to Exodus to Leviticus to Numbers. It draws a running history all the way up, and it comes to its halt right here at the rebuilding of the wall, the regathering of the people, and the waiting for their Messiah. Let's stand together tonight with our heads bowed. Next week we will look at that book of Esther.